this is continuing on December 3rd with Plato Malazimov and Eleanor Slim. All right, you were talking about block caving at
the Alaska Juno. And the caving method was developed actually in Arizona in copper ores, so-called porphyry ores, the characteristic of which is not that they were true porphyries, but perhaps it was a misnomer applied to any of the disseminated copper ores, disseminated because they were intensely fractured in the course of deposition of the minerals, the hydrothermal solutions carrying copper, and therefore having been intensely fractured and copper deposited in these fractures, these ores were essentially weak, so that when they were caved, they would break up. So that, the method of drawing the ore that broke up naturally by gravity through the draw points worked very well in those instances, because the lumps of ore would be reduced as a result of gravity slumping. And comparatively small parts of it would come down in large enough lumps that they would not go through the grizzly and had to be further broken up either by powder or, as they do now, by air hammers. In Alaska Juno, the ore was a highly silicified, almost essentially quartz ore, which, while it had some fracturing, did not at all have the properties that porphyry copper ores that I've just described have in Arizona. Therefore, the caving was really not very successful. It was not breaking up well, and the draw points would continuously be choked by very large lumps of ore that could not go through the openings, the size of the openings it provided. So the chore of those that were attending the draw points was that they had to climb up these draw points, place dynamite charges on the safest mud, so-called mud packs, and then blast them from below. This was essentially a very dangerous job, because you can never know, as they approached and placed their mud packs and so on, at what point all of a sudden the blocked ore might move a little and some of the ores might come down, and they had a lot of accidents, some fatal accidents as a result of that, and these daredevils, the Russian officers, were willing to take these risks. It was some of the what they told me about and how they did that I've reconstructed just now into why that mine had such problems, not only metallurgical, but mining. And it was actually a failure. The mine had never made any ore. The original idea that Fred Bradley had here was this a very, very large ore body. I imagine it must have assayed something like 6 to 8 hundredths of an ounce per ton, which is very low grade, and the only way he could really do it successfully by mass mining, very large scale, and that's what he instituted, large mass mining by caving in this very large mill that he tried to get as much tonnage through as possible, partly by sorting and partly by the methods that they misapplied actually in the mill. So the whole thing was a failure because of poor conception, lack of knowledge, lack of understanding of some fundamentals, mining principles and fundamental metallurgical principles. This is a terrible indictment of the Fred Bradley enterprise, but that's the way I came to the conclusion over the years after I gained my experience in mining.
Did you have any observation of the mine just down the channel?
The Alaska Treadwell?
Well, that was across on the island, wasn't
it? That's the first tragic mistake that was made. It was flooded by by seawater and never was recovered.
Wasn't there a Jackling Enterprise that was adjacent to Alaska Juno, just to the south?
The only one I know of any size was the Alaska Treadwell. There may have been others. There were some smaller mines around there, but I don't recall that. Well, if you're thinking of the famous Kennecott mine that Jackling started way...
That was far away.
That was far away and very high grade and quite successful.
But there was one just adjacent to the Alaska Juno.
Well, that's Alaska Treadwell.
Just to the south, on the mainland, though.
No, it was on the island and extending into the channel.
Yes, that was Treadwell.
That was Treadwell. And they got too close to the sea bottom and finally broke through and flooded the mine, and the mine is still there, flooded with seawater.
Yes, that had happened long before you were there, huh?
Oh, yes.
That was
20
That's
years
right. before. Yes. Yeah.
It was... Well, at any rate, that was a small, short period of that I spent there, but it was of great value to me in learning something about practical mining, of what not to do, how to avoid an unsuccessful enterprise.
Did you have any experience at that time with any of the Newmont properties up in Galilee?
No, not at that time. Well, it was after this, I came back to California, and there was no other job, and that I applied for Columbia University Scholarship, and I went to Columbia University, that I just
yes.
related.
And then back again.
Then, back again, I came to California, to Videlsky. This time, he offered me a job, but it took some negotiation before he finally accepted it. I tried to hold out for $150 a month, and he held out for $120 a month, and he won out. I came back to work for him for $120 a month, but it was a permanent job, so I felt quite gratified.
This would have been in 1934?
This would be in 1934.
So $120 was more then than it is now.
Oh, yes, it is. It was a very interesting job in that as a metallurgical engineer, and so was Dividensky, he's practically turned over to me, even despite my youth, most of the test work that had come in and for which Pan American Engineering and their employees served as consultants. And I worked for them for nearly 5 years, and I must have tested hundreds of samples from many, many mines in California, Nevada, Oregon, Arizona, Colorado, and Montana. So that entire western area, and of course, the reason for this activity and the reason that I got the job is that in 1934, Roosevelt finally changed the price of gold from $20.67 an ounce to $35 an ounce, and this stimulated the production or the search for gold ores and production from old mines that were reopened, and the entire West was sort of brought alive again, especially in terms of gold enterprises, and we were there just at the right time. The company manufactured two basic pieces of equipment. Both of them were one of them was invented by a German metallurgist, an inventor by the name of Max Kraut, K-R-A-U-T. He invented the Kraut flotation machine, and he also invented a Kraut jig. Jigs are gravity concentration devices that had been developed for many, many years and used essentially in lead ores. And so the jig that was standardized for that practice was called the Hartz jig, H-A-R-T-Z. Kraut conceived that for gold ores, this would not be altogether satisfactory. The characteristic of the Hartz jig is that the pulsations of causing the water to go through the bed and then sucking it down were at a very slow pulsation rate of sometimes 40, 50 pulsations a minute. And that as a result of this, the downstroke, which would close and tighten the bed, would prevent the gold from really coming down and being concentrated down below in what is called the hutch. And however, with very fast pulsations, you could keep the bed in suspension and permit the gold gradually to come down and concentrate in the hutch while getting rid of the gang or waste more efficiently. And indeed, he invented, therefore, a special pulsating valve that would be outside of the jig, which would pulsate 300 to 500 pulsations a minute rather than 40 or 50. But just by water pressure, it was actually a rubber valve that would pulsate depending on what pressure of water you had and what quantity of water went through this. And you could adjust the pulsation rate to some extent by the pressure of the water. At any rate, he applied this for gold ores quite successfully, and it worked quite well. And one of the The adjustment of the pulsations was sometimes of importance as to what kind of ore you had, whether it was coarse or fine, and affected the recovery of gold within the jig. So this adjustment had to be made, but unfortunately at that time, and we didn't have any sophisticated instruments that could measure the rate of pulsation of this valve. Because of my musical education and used to very fast tempos with many, many notes played for every beat, that kind of thing, I was able, because of that, to actually count every five or every six beats rather than every beat. I could not have counted every beat, so I could approximate fairly closely what the pulsation rate was within maybe 20 or 30 pulsation rate error. And that was sort of a unique ability that I was able to impart to the technical aspect of trying to adjust the pulse rate, which was curious. Videnski used to laugh at me at this, and he says, I think you're imagining this. He was musical also, as a matter of fact, but somehow he never applied this to the problem at hand. I may mention here in passing that Videnski was quite a good pianist, and during my work for Pan American Engineering, he and I got together and we played regularly sonatas and other pieces. I had the violin and he played the piano, so we had a very ongoing relationship in the music phase that was that cemented our our friendship.
Him, but I didn't realize he was a musician also.
He was a good pianist.
I didn't know that.
Originally, as he told me, when he first came to this country, he was a teenager and he went to college. He didn't have any support, so he had to make his own way. And the way he made his way was during the silent film days. He would play the piano to accompany the silent films and would improvised music and so on that would would be necessary for support of musical support of the silent movies. He played in this, in these old cinemas for several years. So he was nearly a professional musician. Well, in addition to that, the Pan American Engineering Company and D. Videnski had a rather warm, friendly relationship with a man who worked for Plaster Development Company, which had an office in the Russ Building in San Francisco. Their fame was based there, based essentially on very bold and successful efforts at developing new gold fields, actually in New Guinea, and New Guinea, where in most inaccessible areas, they developed a placer gold field, where they sent in, erected dredges and produced gold. And in these dredges, they were pioneering, actually, in the use of jigs. And they developed their own jig called the placer jig. And they used them for one or two dredges there. And then later on, they had expanded into Colombia. And through, I guess, the friendship that Videnski had, they finally awarded the license to manufacture these jigs to Pan American Engineering Company. So Pan American had three products to sell, in effect, the Kraut jig, the Kraut flotation machine, which was essentially also designed for gold ores, and the placer development jig. And one of my jobs was, besides doing the metallurgical testing on a consulting basis, was try to see if I could sell any of this equipment for the operations for which I worked out a successful metallurgical solution. So I was really a sort of a consulting engineer and a salesman at the same time for some 5 years and traveled very widely throughout the West. And I have notes of some of these trips and names of the people and the names of the companies that served. And some of them I made repeated visits to, and some I succeeded in selling the equipment, some I didn't. But it was a very busy, busy time. I did a lot of traveling and spent, I suppose, probably 60 or 70% of my time traveling, and about 30 to 40% of my time at the base doing the metallurgical consulting work.
How did you travel?
By car. Company car. They had, I think they standardized on Dodges. Mm-hmm. But I traveled thousands of miles every year all over the West.
Did you ever get to New Guinea?
To where?
New Guinea?
No.
This is Gunala?
No, this is all in the West. The only diversion from that was Plaster Development had an operation and stock holding in an operation of a gold dredging enterprise in Colombia. And I was asked by them to go down there and to install plaster jigs as test jigs to see whether it would be applicable to those dredging operations. And I spent a good part of two or three months doing that. In Colombia, well, they had one dredge at Asnazu, A-S-N-A-Z-U, which was close to the capital of Colombia. And the other one was at Pato, on the Pato River, which is a tributary of the Magdalena River in the jungle in northern Colombia. They had, I think it was two or three dredges there, so it was a large mining camp. The effort of demonstrating the jig was successful, and they eventually put in jigs and all four dredges. Also, as a result of this activity, I visited the then also very active and successful operations, dredging operations in Alaska, which were near Fairbanks, owned by United States Smelting and Refining Company. And there again, I came out to demonstrate the superior performance of the jigs over the riffles that they had installed in those dredges, and spent two or three months demonstrating this. It was a sort of a comical incident in connection with that work. I did this work for the company, and at the head of the company, a man by name of Hopkins was the general manager, and he was apparently originally with one of the security companies with some military background. He was not very well liked because he was a martinet having that background and had some very rigid notions of how to treat people and what was secret, and he mistrusted everyone terribly. So that when I got there and I began my my testing, I found to my amazement that the gold that I recovered in the testing procedure was taken away from me, and I wasn't able to weigh it or do anything. And this was given to the employer because he mistrusted me, that he thought somehow I would not give the right results give the wrong recommendation. At any rate, so I worked in the blind for about two or three months as to whether I was successful or not successful. I came to the end of my my demonstration period, and I felt that I was successful because while I didn't weigh the product, I saw the product, and we were doing the recovery, and from my previous experience, I felt sure that we were doing a better job than the riffles were doing. So I went to Hopkins and I said, well, I would like to have the results that you have weighed, and I'll use your figures in order to write a report and my recommendations. He says, you can't have it. He says, this is secret. We're going to make our own recommendations. I said, well, this is unheard of. He says, I'm a consulting engineer, and of course I have a reputation for honesty, and I'm not going to misuse these things. You can examine my conclusions, and there's going to be no possible suspicion of any of any doctoring of the results in the way I work. No, you cannot have them. Well, I says, in that case, I guess my service to you is ended right here, and I stalked out. I was supposed to complete this thing and do some more work. So as soon as I got back to Fairbanks, I called up the airline and booked a passage the next morning. I was terribly angry and put out over this whole thing. First experience of lack of confidence me that I've experienced in my life, because I had the reputation of being an honest person. Strangely enough, very early in the morning, next morning, probably at 6 o'clock, and my flight left at 8, Mr. Hopkins calls me and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm leaving today at 8 o'clock. Well, don't leave, says, I want to see you. So I canceled my trip, went out to see him, says, well, here are the results. Says, here are the results. He says, you can write your report. So then the next week or 10 days, I wrote the report, and as I expected, it was positive, and I recommended putting in the jigs, and I rendered the report and went to Hopkins, and he read the report. He complimented me on the report. It's a very good report, and I think we'll probably follow up your recommendations. And then before I just got up to leave, and says, I want to talk to you about something else. I said, you know that this is a seasonal operation. It says, we operate only in warm weather, and in the wintertime we shut down. And of course we have to maintain personnel and people to see that everything is okay and so on. And I leave during the wintertime. Would you like to have a job to replace me during the wintertime?
Quite a turnaround.
Quite a turnaround. It didn't take me very long to say no to that, because what was the point of my being a caretaker during the wintertime when there was nothing going on? So I turned him down, but thanked him for the confidence that he expressed in me.
So he did trust you after all.
Well, those were the two outstanding experiences I had, I think, in applying post-test work that I did. I may say only one other thing that relates to that period. In terms of jigging, there is another experience I must relate later on. But in terms of jigging, it was a pioneering effort. Nobody had ever applied jigs to gold operations, although placer development did do it for dredges. But no one had applied it for the ores that were at that time mined and treated in California and other western states. The characteristic of many of these ores is that they were not necessarily free milling gold ores. Many of these ores, because they were deeper, actually were ores in which sulfide appeared in the way of pyrite. And pyrite was auriferous. And we found out, as a result of the testing, that in almost all instances, so-called auriferous pyrite, which was before then considered to be something where gold would go with pyrite, and the only way you could recover it is to grind it very fine in cyanide and get the gold that way. Actually, some part of the gold was free of pyrite, and at certain grinding, depending on the degree of grinding, you could increase the amount of gold that would be free as compared to that which would go with the pyrite that required special treatment. And this was evidenced, of course, in part of the grinding circuit that was used prior to the use of jigs. They had found that they had to install traps, they called them hydraulic traps, on a ball mill discharge before the material would get to the classifier again. And these ball mill traps were supposed to concentrate the fine steel particles that would be formed as a result of abrasion of the liners and the balls, heavier than the ore, and they would settle down, and unless they were settled out in the separate traps, they would interfere after being accumulated in the classifier with the classifying action. Well, it was known, people did know, that gold tend to concentrate in those traps as well. That led us to the feeling that it was worth investigating further. So at any rate, we applied jigs to instead of the traps, and this turned out to be a very successful, new, brand new development. This is a pioneering development, and I would say that Pan American Engineering was on the initial pioneering work in this. And I developed for assessment of to what extent you could, what recoveries you could make of this free gold at what grinding by what I called in the reports that I wrote, simulated jigging. It was a very simple device that I invented myself of using an ordinary gold miner's pan, which is a dish that you jiggle around in order to get rid of the gang and concentrate the gold underneath. And this supplemented with a small water jet stream directed to the bottom of the pan, so that in effect, as the water would come up, it would start coming up through the ore, and would be very similar as a result of the shaking of the thing to what the jig was actually doing. And by perfecting that technique, I found that I could predict the recovery by the jigs very closely, within 5, sometimes 10% of actual recovery that the jigs would do, just by this simulated, very simple test that I developed. And it was the operators, usually when I spoke of this in my report, they said, well, what kind of a jig is this that you've tried this? I said, well, there's no jig, it's a simulated jigging action that I developed. And they would say, well, that's impossible, we don't believe it. But then my test results were so close to the actual results when the machine was put in that they finally this was something that was believed in as a reliable tool. But it required certain personal skills to how you operated this, which I developed at that time. So this helped me a great deal, of course, in my sales effort of installing jigs based on metallurgical results and testing that I did in the laboratory. Another phase that I think is of some interest was the involvement of a new flotation machine that was the idea of which was brought to Videnski, and so he thought well enough of it to try to see if it could be developed. I forget the name of the inventor right now, but this flotation machine was called by him a deep cell. Instead of having a float, at that time flotation machines were usually 2, 3, 4 foot deep, and this one was something like 15 or 20 feet deep. And the theory about was that it would have an enormous capacity, and also with a depth of column of water and release of air down at the bottom of the machine, the small bubbles, the bubbles would be compressed to a very small size, and gradually as they would rise at the flotation machine, they would get larger, and that mechanism would caused them to be more efficient in collecting the sulfide minerals and the froth into the froth. That was the general theory. At any rate, they sold Videnski on this, and we heard of a large pilot plant being planned for Morenci ore body by Phelps Dodge. Actually, the Morenci ore body was a huge ore body that Phelps Dodge decided that they, before building the mill, they wanted to build the most modern mill and the best equipment that existed in the world at that time. So
One, this is a concept that was, I think, dictated by Lou Cates of Phelps Dodge. In this pilot mill that I finally built at Morenci in Arizona, they were going to test 7 different flotation machines, so that in effect, and the pilot plant had a capacity of 10,000 tons a day. So it's not really, the size is that of a commercial plant, but they wanted to do it, everything on a full scale. And they had a number of ball mills, full-size ball mills, and each one was tested separately against the other. The flotation machines that I speak of, different classifiers, different filters, different thickeners, and so on. Very expensive efforts, with the general idea that when you put one against the competition, then you could choose the very, very best one. Pan American decided to enter this competition with this new deep cell, brand new thing. Everybody was quite surprised at this whole thing. Anyway, I was charged with the responsibility of trying to prove out this cell against everybody else. This effort of piloting the various equipment lasted for about 2 years. And for 2 years, I used to commute from Berkeley, California to Morenci, Arizona, which took usually 2 days. And I always drove, and I would visit and at least make 5 or 6 trips a year, and stay for sometimes 2 weeks, sometimes a month. And there were junior metallurgists that would run this, but I would supervise the whole thing. Well, at any rate, this. And other people, all the companies. So I was competing against 7 other companies, and Pan American Engineering was one of the smaller companies. We were competing against Dor Oliver and against American Cyanamid with their cell, and other cells. At any rate, significant part of it, and it's recorded by a paper that I wrote together with Bob Ramsey. Ramsey was then working for me, and he was the metallurgist on site. And I wrote up the technical aspects of our of this competitive effort. And I will just mention the outstanding thing that I found out. I began to suspect that the deep cell concept, as it was explained to us by the inventor, was not working well. I was not able to get much greater capacity in it than the normal other cells were getting, the same of same dimension, except that they were much shallower. So finally I became convinced that the deep part of it was really of no use at all. So I made the radical recommendation and insisted on it, and the company and Videnski allowed me to do this. I said, I think we can demonstrate that depths idea is of no use to us, and I propose to sand up the cells so that I'll have a sand bottom in effect, and I'll have a shallow cell. And there are certain changes in this cell that I want to make that would make them more efficient and give me permission to do that. I did, and of course the inventor was outraged. This whole principle was going was ruined by this. And we did it, however, and such changes as I made, and as I say, it was all recorded in a technical paper that Bob Ramsey and I made and was written in Mining and Engineering and Mining Journal. I succeeded in proving that I was right. Depth had nothing to do with either efficiency or the capacity. And certain changes that I made demonstrated also that the principle of what we called in those days hog trough design, which meant that all you needed is some impellers, but you could have just a hog trough of a vessel in which these impellers would be operating. That was as good or perhaps better than the more sophisticated concepts that, for example, Fagergren cells had, which was American Sinomet product, in which this was the largest company that was promoting them, which had a very complicated way of circulating and recirculating the pulp before it gets to the next cell and cascading action and so on. Very complicated, rather expensive. Anyway, what I proved, and I had the results. Again, I was not privy to the results of the competing cells, only to my own. But I was able somehow to get the results, and at least from time to time, because all the competitors were friends of mine, actually, and they did reveal to me some of the results. I'm satisfied that this hog trough idea, and we had the only one of the simplest cells, and they're simple and cheap to build and so on, and we actually outperformed every other cell and among those that were tested at that time. So I was quite disappointed that the final choice of the cells, flotation cells for the final mill, were Fagergen cells, which, yeah, because American Sinomet was the largest company, and they had offices in New York. They had people that knew Phelps Dodge people at the top, and they finally forced the acceptance of a cell that actually was not the best cell at all. And, so we failed in our attempt there, but it was an extremely interesting experience, which, as I said, is written up in the Engineering and Mining Journal. I think that ends my sort of summary of my experience with Pan American Engineering Company. It was a period when, while I was engaged in essentially in the metallurgical aspects of every operation that I had anything to do with, yet inevitably I was exposed also to the mining aspect of it. So I learned quite a bit about dredging, for example, and what makes good and bad dredging operations, what makes a good dredge master and a bad dredge master, and what the problems are. So I learned a good deal. As a matter of fact, that was the period that I learned a great deal about placer mining, its testing, its reliability of testing, what the problems are in this and so on. And the same thing about mining of the others. But of course, all the other mines that I visited were all small mines. In those days, the largest mining operation actually was Newmont's operation in Grass Valley. And I did visit there, and I tried to sell them the jigs too. And Frank McQuiston was metallurgical engineer at the operation in Grass Valley, so I renewed my acquaintance with him, and we did install jigs there as well. At any rate, that 5 years served not only as building up my experience and gaining confidence in my own ability to solve metallurgical problems, but also by attrition, you might say, or by exposure to it, I learned a great deal about mining, testing of mining properties, what made a successful property and what made a failure. So I consider that 5-year period as extremely important in terms of my learning something about operations and how it should be done, the management style of one company is against the other, and what organization it takes, and what is efficient and what is not efficient, and so on. So I think that that's served by just observation, schooling in the management practices as well as operations, although I was essentially involved in just a narrow phase of it, of the metallurgical expertise and the metallurgical processes.
Were you meeting people? I suppose you were.
I think maybe we can stop here.
You probably were meeting a lot of people that you later knew.
Yes, I did. Yes.
All right, well, this is a good time to stop.